Live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Welcome back. I'm Scott Buttram here at News Talk 770 AM 92.5 FM WVNN. We will be joined shortly by Representative Danny Garrett. Danny chairs the Ways, or co-chairs the Ways and Means Education Committee, which means he is the guy who handles all the money for the state and decides where it goes, along with his colleagues in the House. Danny, I appreciate you coming on, and welcome aboard.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you today.
Well, I've got some really bad news to start off our interview here, Danny. And I probably should tell you, you're my last guest for the day, and I've got to be here till 5, so I plan to keep you until Carol drags you off the phone, just so you know ahead of time. Our last guest was Andrew Sorrell, and of course we spent most of the interview talking about the constitutional carry bill that Governor Ivey signed into law yesterday. I guess we can start calling it a law already, even though it doesn't kick in until January 1st. But at the very end, I said, hey, Andrew, tell me what are the big wins of this session, and what are we going to miss on? And the very first thing out of his mouth, we did away with the privilege tax. And I told him, I said, if Danny's listening, he's throwing up. You just stole his thunder. So that I know, that was a really big win for small business owners in the state of Alabama. And you carried that through.
Well, I'm chair of the Small Business Commission, and we had a number of tax bills and other measures we've worked on with Lieutenant Governor to try to come up with a package of bills. That actually was the number one request from small business owners for many years. So we were happy to get that passed out of the House yesterday.
Yeah, as a small business owner myself, sending the state a $100 check for what appears to be nothing every year, it's not a lot of money, but it's just kind of aggravating and nagging. If we're trying to be a pro-business state and grow businesses, send me $100 for nothing doesn't seem like the best deal in the world.
Well, calling it a privilege tax was the first mistake. And the second thing is that a lot of people actually have to pay accountants or lawyers more money than the $100 to pay. You have to pay the tax. So
right.
We're glad to get rid of it.
Let's talk about there were quite a few bills put forth with your name on it, and they were financial bills, so that's kind of the way that works. Talk about what you see as the biggest victories from bills you put out and who that's going to benefit and how.
Well, of course, this week the House passed education budget, and that's a big undertaking. It actually included 9 bills. What I like about the bill, and I'll just say this too, you know, there are a lot of things that I would, if I were the king, I would do things differently. But as you pull the package of things together, I think we're on the right road in terms of in this budget, we're paying down debt. We're paying off the PAC payment. We're fully funding the budget stabilization reserve. We are putting investments into some things that I think are going to maybe potentially move the needle in education. For example, we are focusing directly into these underperforming schools and not just throwing money at them, but have some targeted strategic initiatives to address those. We are also expanding the pre-K classrooms, adding 125 of those across the state. That's become very successful and nationally recognized. And that's a key as we roll forward in education to have a good pre-K program. And we're putting more money directly into classrooms. We're also doing some things on an innovative front to attract teachers. There's a nationwide teacher shortage. It's a problem in Alabama that's even exacerbated because we have so many areas that are just poor in facilities, poor in, you know, internet, just, you know, a plethora of reasons. So we're doing some things to try to strategically target getting teachers into those areas where we really need them in these underperformed classrooms.
Danny, we are ranked 50th in the state, and that's well known. We talk about it all the time. And I don't know if I mentioned before you came on, but you're from Trussville. The listeners know I'm from Trussville. But we're here in the Athens, Huntsville area on this radio station. And so just in the interest of full disclosure, Danny and I have been friends for a long time, really way before he went to Montgomery as a state representative, and we're very proud of the job he's doing. So if this sounds a little one-sided, it is. And, you know, we'll just be upfront about that. I needle you a lot, and I push you a lot. But you just made a really valid point, and you know, people that don't know us don't know that you're constantly reminding me that you're not king. You do have to work with other people, because I would prefer you just go up there and decree what needs to be done. On the school funding, am I wrong in saying that this is the biggest education budget in Alabama state history?
It is.
Do we have
if
some accountability?
If you look at the nominal funding and go back to 2008, it would be $8.7 billion. Yes, the largest number. And I challenge that too, because the governor sent across a budget of $8.3 billion. The cap calculation, that basically is way you determine how much money we can spend, mm-hmm. would have allowed us to spend $9 billion. Now, all of this is all crazy because of the federal infusion. We've had over $50 billion of cash and into the state,
right?
And that's made our numbers look really skewed. But we took the governor's 8.3 and we knocked another 125 million off of that. And so it's $500 million more than we spent last year. But we're still going to have a lot of resources left over. And I think, you know, in the middle of all this, we actually have provided $200 million of tax cuts and tax relief. I should mention that a lot of these small business packages will address or cutting taxes on small businesses. We passed legislation to raise the standard deduction and the exemptions for taxpayers who make less than $50,000. That will be a big benefit to a lot of taxpayers. We are, for the first time ever, passing legislation that would exempt people who are drawing from defined contribution plans. If you're over age 65, the first $6,000 of that per individual. So a household who's drawing from a 401k, you're over 65, the first $12,000 will no longer be taxed in Alabama. In the past, defined benefit plans are not taxed, but defined contribution plans are. So these are steps towards some tax reform that are measured and targeted, helping individuals that really need that help: small business, senior citizens, people under $50,000. And I think there's more reform we need to do. We just have to do it in a measured basis and make sure we don't, you know, make bad decisions. You make your worst decisions when you have a lot of money.
Right.
And that's where we are right now. So we're trying to be prudent. And I think we have been. I would have probably been a little more prudent, but I think what we have is a good solid budget. I'm comfortable with the amount of reserves we have that we're going to have going forward. And again, paying down $200 million of debt, fully paying off that PAC program, which is $177 million, and putting $111 million to fully fund the Rolling Reserve Act, which is what keeps us out of proration. Those are significant measures that I think are good, sound financial decisions.
Yeah, and you know, we should point out to listeners the 50 billion that came from the federal government. That was one time money. So you can't put that into projects that are going to require ongoing funding unless you've got it somewhere else.
That's right. Well, it's one time, but it continues to come. We're going to have another $1 billion come, yeah, you know, this July, this ARPA funding. So it's slowing down. One indication we had was, I think, that the sales tax receipts last month were flat. And that, to me, is kind of a bellwether. Maybe people have received all the stimulus money, and maybe a lot of that is now, you know, maybe we're seeing the benefits of this, and the sales income tax is beginning to start to wane. But we're about to have another slew of $1 billion in cash coming in. And that's, you know, That, but you're right, we can't be dependent upon that.
Let's step back to the education budget. Are there any accountability measures in there for schools performing at a higher level? How does that work?
Yeah, so one thing we're doing in the budget is that we're putting a lot of money. Let me go back to these rankings too. There are a lot of schools in our state that are probably in the top 10% nationwide.
Right.
But we have so many that are in the bottom 10%, so many more than the bottom 10%, that's what weights our averages down.
That's right.
So if you want to fix the state, if you want to raise the state ranking, you go to those areas that need the attention. And what we tend to do in Montgomery is take the pot of money, divide it by 67 counties, and everybody gets the same amount. And we never really go to these root problems and fix them. So in this budget, we're trying to look at those lowest performing schools and what can we do to move the needle there. There's some real challenges there. But one thing we've done, and particularly with math, which is woeful in these scores, and where we I think we're 52nd in math. There is a numeracy bill. Now, some people don't like the numeracy bill.
Right.
It hasn't passed House yet. It did pass the Senate. It passed out of House committee this week. But whether it's the numeracy bill or another initiative, what we want to do is put a lot of focus into those areas that in early grades, in these poor performing schools that need good math instruction. Now, if the numeracy bill passes, there's some accountability provisions in there that are pretty significant. After a period of time, if those test scores or those performance doesn't improve, then that school will be reconstituted, which means that school will be, the state takes it over. Everybody from the principal on down is pink slipped, and then you're able to hire back teachers. This happened in Mobile, I believe it was the George Hall School, mm-hmm. that was reconstituted, and it's kind of a model for this. If it's not reconstituted, it may also convert to a charter school. And so when you go to a conversion charter, you do the same thing. You pink slip everybody and you start over, and now you're under the charter rules, which you have more flexibility.
Right.
Now, we have three conversion charters going on right now in Montgomery. It's too early to really tell how that's going to work out. But what this opens the door for, if you think about it, is, number one, these schools know that if we don't perform, then something's going to happen. We're going to either be reconstituted, or we're going to be a charter school. We're going to be gone. So that threat may generate some activity. But the other thing is, it opens the door to getting rid of tenure. And these
right.
things that sometimes I think have strapped our educational efforts in the state. So it's a good segue, I think, into saying if you don't perform, don't produce outcomes, there's going to be some change. But to be fair, we have to make sure that we're adequately providing the resources for that to happen. You can't just decree it and then not have the proper resources in those classrooms and expect any change in results. So there's some accountability in the Numeracy Act. And I, for one, hope it passes. A lot of people, there are a few people, I don't know how many, but there's a fair number of people who don't like it because they believe it's a reinforcement of Common Core. I just disagree with their whole thinking on that. But I think that you're right, that accountability has to be part of what we do, or we're not going to have any change.
Danny, we're coming up on a break. Can you stay over for another segment with us?
Sure.
Great. Thanks. Hold on. And I'm Scott Buttram in for Phil Williams here at Right Side Radio. We'll be right back after this here at News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Scott Buttram, sitting in for Phil Williams here at Right Side Radio in Athens, Alabama. Joining us, and he's been with us for the past segment, we're bringing him back again, is Danny Garrett, Representative Danny Garrett of Trustful. Danny, you blew my mind a little bit as you were talking a little about the accountability measure for underperforming schools. I grew up in Tuscaloosa, and I guess I should back up. I'm a huge, huge school choice proponent. I think it is critical. I agree with you. Some of Alabama's best schools can compete with any schools in the country. The problem is the number of bad schools and how widespread it is really brings the entire state average down. Growing up in Tuscaloosa, right next to the Black Belt, an area that I dearly love, and man, it just kills me to see that part of our state dying on the vine because the kids that do get out and can find a way out, they never go back. And race has nothing to do with it because people are disappearing from some of those Black Belt counties of both races, and they don't want to go back because they don't want to raise their kids in the schools they grew up in. Watching that area all of my life, I've also seen a lot of money dumped over there that just disappears, and we could talk an entire show about that. Are you confident that the system of if a state takeover is required, are you confident it can happen before assets are squandered?
Yes, because I think the accountability measures in here, there'll be some oversight on this program if the Numeracy Act passes. And again, you've got the reconstitution of school is one option. The other option is it converts to a charter, which it moves not from a state takeover, but under the Charter School Commission. And so I think we're now focused and going to be, you know, targeting on that. We also have some very unique things going on with teacher recruitment, because one of the problems when you talk about choice in those areas is there's really no choice. There's no other option, and you can't get teachers in those areas. So we've got a virtual hub right now in Birmingham under a pilot program teaching into a classroom in Bullock County, and we're watching that to see if that can be a model that maybe can help us as we move forward. We had a presentation this week from the president of Stillman College here in Tuscaloosa, who actually is doing a program. She's got a lot of black belt students, and she is basically mandating that all of her students, graduates from Stillman, are going to have teaching credentials, because that's their electives, their minor will be in teaching. And what she's going to do is basically try to recruit a lot of these biology majors or kids who will have a degree in some, you know, but won't really be going to a job where they use that degree, into that teaching profession, help them do practice preparation, help them with boot camp to get into that deal. And also a lot of these kids from those black belt areas who are under federal loan program can go back and teach and get loan forgiveness. There's a lot of things like that that are innovative, that are new, that we're
trying. We're up against Danny, we're up against a hard break. Can I get you to hold on for one more segment with me? We'll be right back with Right Side Radio. This is Scott Buttram sitting in for Phil Williams. Welcome back. This is Scott Buttram at Right Side Radio. Joining us is Representative Danny Garrett out of Trustful. Danny, we were still talking a little bit about the charter, the possible charter takeover of schools who don't perform to level when they get this additional funding that the state is allocating to those areas. When I first heard about state takeover, the first thing that popped in my mind were the Birmingham City Schools. And we all remember, I think Ed Richardson, I don't remember if he was superintendent. Maybe he had retired, but he was sent in to take over the Birmingham City Schools. They had a board that was in complete disarray, and I thought did a good job getting the right people on the board and in place, but it was temporary. The school, you know, the state, when they righted the ship, or felt like they had righted the ship to the best of their ability, they walked away from it. I was looking at statewide test scores last week as it relates to the Alabama Literacy Act. I just wanted to see where different school systems and schools ranked. And they're at the very bottom of the list, the Birmingham City Schools. I mean, rock bottom in the state of Alabama. So that state takeover didn't work. I think what I really like about this plan that you guys have implemented is this is a permanent change to education in areas that don't get their act together.
A lot of things come a broad term. I think school choice is coming, whether people like it or not. I think it's going to get to a point where, and I'm all for it. We've got a bill in our committee this week that's going to be looking at have a public hearing on, you know, some of the dollars following a student from a student who transfers within a county. That's one bill.
Right.
I spoke to Representative Meadows yesterday. She's trying to get her bill, which is the initial school choice bill, that kind of got the conversation started. She's working on that, and we'll probably be ready for us to take that bill up in our committee the following week. But what you know, school choice is going to happen, I think. But what we got to make sure of is that where these counties and these cities and these areas of the state where there is no choice, if we just have school choice in the areas with a choice and we leave those schools behind, we're not going to improve anything statewide.
Right.
And so that's part of the focus here with this Numeracy Act and things like that, is designed to say, look, we're going to go to these worst of the worst, and we're going to do what we can to bring those up. So I think you're going to see accountability in some of these measures. And again, numeracy has not passed the House yet, but
yeah,
I'm hopeful it will.
Well, I agree with you. I think school choice, it's sweeping the country, especially in Republican-controlled states, and it's going to come to Alabama. That's inevitable. And I look at the arguments from the Democrats, who are very closely tied to AEA, and it's their areas that stand to gain the most because their schools
are
suffering.
Well, let me just say, school choice, if you say that, like to some people, school choice means I have my child in a private school, I want to be able to get reimbursed state dollars for that.
Right.
I'm really okay with that, you know, but that's not really school choice. You're already in that situation.
Yeah.
You're just kind of, you know, softening the financial impact of that. But the school choice, a lot of people say, well, if you're in this zip code, you should have another choice. I agree with that. But I'm just telling you, practically, in some of these zip codes, there is no other choice.
Right.
So how are we going to bring about those choices? That's what I'm really think is really important as we evaluate all of these things.
Yeah, and even and I'm thinking again of the Black Belt counties, even where there is an option, there's usually only one option, and they're very small. I think every county probably has a private school. Most of them have segregated years and years ago, but they're small. They could only take
students. And it may be 40 miles away.
Yeah, it could be. That's right. And I grew up with friends that drove 40 miles to go to school every day in Greene County, Hale County, some of these, Sumter County. And some of those have gone away. Some of them are still there, but they're small. And the number of kids that might want to transfer, they might be able to help some of them, but they wouldn't be able to take as many that
well,
need
I think,
to make
I think,
the move.
I think that the conversion charter, basically under the Calabity Act right now, a school can convert to a church conversion charter.
Right.
And when you do that, you have a lot more flexibility and you can do more things. The problem is, though, in these Black Belt areas and some areas of the state, even if they did that, where are we going to get the teachers?
Right.
And so that's why we're doing some other things in this budget and to basically try to address that. That's why I'm so excited about what this Stillman College is doing. At least she sees the vision.
Right.
At least she understands that, hey, there's a way we can get people into these areas. But that's the big thing. How do we hire the teachers? Where do we get them? And that's a challenge in the state.
It really is, and there's going to be another challenge. I'm going to put it out on Twitter yesterday because when I saw it online, I got very excited. You know that there's going to be an uphill battle with the education industrial complex in this state, who are going to try their best to defend their turf and really defend their money. That's all they really care about. You returned a $10,000 campaign contribution to AEA earlier. Well, it was last month, I guess. February 1st was the date I saw. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I'm chair of the education budget. I'm chair of the education budget committee. And as part of that, I need to be impartial in evaluating issues that come before us. AEA is going to be bringing their opinions and their requests before us, and their members will be. And I need to be in a position where the decisions I make, it's clear that I'm not influenced by the people who are contributing money. And I think I want people to know that if I make a decision or set the agenda, I'm not doing it because of some outside influence. And I want the outside influences to know that you can't influence me to do that. So I just felt like it was the right thing to do, the appropriate thing to do. And I don't want the perception to be that we're doing anything that's inappropriate. I mean, I think that's just the best thing to do. That's what I did.
Well, I tweeted out a copy of the receipt, and I don't mind telling you the tweet kind of went crazy after that. It was it got a very positive response, and there has been a concern. I've been vocal about it. Unfortunately, the rest of the legislators, or fortunately for them, they get to go back to their towns, and they don't have to deal with the local newspaper publisher that just goes on and on and on about stuff. You don't have that luxury. You got to live with me.
So you know
how I am about those things. And one of the things that has really frustrated and aggravated me is that the Alabama Republican Party passed a rule. We had Marty Collins on Tribune Unscripted. I'm sorry, Marty Connors on Tribune Unscripted this week, and I asked him when that rule went into place about Republican candidates not accepting AEA campaign contributions. I thought it was 2010. He said he thought it was 2005. Before the Republicans actually took over.
I don't know that I really think that's a good rule. I mean, I think that, I mean, you know, I got to the legislature in 2014. That was after AEA had lost all their influence. We had a Republican supermajority. So, I mean, even Donald Trump gave the Democrats and Republicans. I mean, I think some of that gets overplayed.
Well, but go back to 2005 and Paul Hubbard's power.
I guess I'm saying AEA has kind of had to reinvent themselves to deal with the supermajority. And my personal experience with them has not been negative, but, you know, I don't agree with them a lot.
And
the same with the trial lawyers. I don't agree with them a lot. But what I find with them now is basically when they come with an issue or whatever, they're actually trying to just be productive and trying to get the best they can get. And I guess what I'm saying is I don't know that rule is relevant today, and I'm not going to criticize other Republicans who took that money.
Right.
But for me personally, for a lot of reasons, I just didn't need to put myself in that position. And particularly when I'm arbitrating or trying to set an agenda where they're one of the people bringing stuff before us, you know,
I understand that. And I think that's a reasonable approach. I also understand back in 2005, what this state was dealing with Paul Hubbard and his control over the legislature. And I think part of the problem was that while it started as education issues, he personally and that organization became so powerful that they were controlling legislation that had absolutely nothing to do with education.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things in the education budget that really, to me, are I look forward to maybe going through that budget and maybe reevaluating some of what's in there. I'll be honest with you. So,
well, I know you're a numbers geek, so that doesn't surprise me.
One thing before we get the biggest thing, the bill that I've got the most attention, I thought it was a trustful problem, but it turns out it was a statewide problem.
Oh, yeah, the train bill.
And I know Colbert County Commission passed a resolution supporting my bill, which has passed the House, is now up in the Senate. But I've had a lot of conversations with the railroad industry. I had a conversation with Norfolk Southern executives on Thursday. And let's just say that bill's gotten a lot of attention, and hopefully we'll see some improvements going forward.
I'm really glad you brought that up. The Tribune has covered that extensively because we have access to our local representative. But statewide, it may not have gotten as much attention. There may be a lot of people that don't know. We're up here today in the Huntsville area. Share exactly what that bill does. And I'm, before you even get into it, I'm just going to preempt some of our listeners who are thinking, the federal railroads, they're under federal law. He doesn't know what he's doing. You were the vice president of Southern Rail, so you were probably their worst nightmare to come up with this bill.
Well,
know the industry.
We crafted the legislation with the legal folks here, basically in a way that wouldn't be constitutional, because they do have a lot of unique federal protections. Mm-hmm. But basically what spurred this was in Trustville in December. We had a train that sat and blocked the crossing for 10 days.
Yep.
And the problem was, as with all the labor shortage and supply chain issues and workforce issues and COVID and all that stuff, the railroads were slow to change their business model. They couldn't get trains loaded fast enough and couldn't get them unloaded fast enough, but they just sent everything ahead when they got it done, created these bottlenecks all over the state.
Right.
And it was a public nuisance. We couldn't get emergency vehicles, couldn't get people to get to work, we couldn't get school buses. So the bill basically says that if you are going to block a crossing for 2 hours, well, first of all, you can't block a crossing and block emergency vehicles. So basically, if you're blocking a crossing for a prolonged period of time, it's not a mechanical failure. You got to separate the train, which they can do. They don't like to do, but they can do that.
That's right.
But the other thing is, this bill says if it's going to be for more than 2 hours and it's not to one of those situations that are mechanical or something on the track or whatever, then you start paying a fine. And what the railroads don't want is they don't want a patchwork legislation all over the country for this. And so most of the railroads have responded and gotten, you know, have fixed their problems or addressed their problems. Some were slower than others to do it. But like right now, I told the guys in Trustville, I said, I'm going to use a railroad term. If you want to see a train wreck, just wait till they start that interstate construction in Trustville, which diverts all this traffic to Highway 11, and then you block the crossings you're going to see a major train, the mother of all train wrecks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that, the bill is just, it's just simple. They've got to adjust their business models for the world we're in today. And I think we've gotten their attention, and we'll see some better results. But it would accrue a fine of $5,000 per hour, up to $50,000 a day, that would go to that local municipality that's being a nuisance by that blockage.
Right. And I know that in Trustful, one of the things we discovered, and we know the supply chain issue is real, and it's affected right. that industry. But we sent our photographer and videographer to the Irondale rail yard right next to Trustful, who put a drone in the air, and we realized they're basically using the train tracks in Trustful as a parking lot because they can't get anything in their rail yard.
They're going to stop at 25 miles north of Trustful if they can't get into the yard. They told me that yesterday.
That,
so we'll see.
Well, I can see it from my office. I'll let you know if they lie. Hey, Danny, we're up against a break. I want to thank you so much for coming on, and tell Carol I'm sorry I kept you on so long. But nobody wants to listen to me talk to myself for an entire hour. So,
well, I enjoy hearing you. I enjoy your radio voice, and thank you. You better get home before the snow starts.
I'm going straight to the mountain, man. I'm just trying to beat it up the hill before it does. Thank you again, Danny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.